This recording is because the live recordings of the first three commandments, both of them failed. Excuse me, so I'm just speaking now in my room. It's not a live lecture, doing my best to recapture some of the material and at least keep the series continual. So this lecture is on the first three of the Ten Commandments. If you've ever had a breakdown in health and were fortunate enough to meet someone who was able to diagnose the problem accurately and organise for you a proper routine of medicine and diet and exercise, you know from experience the value of following a properly organised routine. So you know the value of good law. If you've ever been part of a team in which everyone was going his or her own way, and you were fortunate enough to find a system that encouraged each person's initiative, but in such a way that the team functioned well as a team, well, you know the value of good law. If you've ever driven if you're an Australian and you've driven a car for the first time in the United States, you'd very welcome someone who came along to you and said, "Look, we drive on the right-hand side here." You'd save an accident, you'd save a lot of difficulty, and you know the purpose of having clear, good law. Well, in this lecture, we're beginning to talk about a law that governed the life of the people of ancient Israel. It was seen by them to be basic to their very existence as a people. They considered it to be a gift to them from God, the author of life itself, and the one who formed them into a nation. They saw themselves as being privileged to have this law, and they delighted in it as in a treasured gift. But I need to make something clear first. We're using the word law to cover what the Hebrew Bible calls the Torah. It was translated into the Greek Septuagint as nomos, which means law or custom, hence our use of the word law. However, it's not a very good translation of Torah. Yara in Hebrew means to walk, to go. And the Torah is the way you walk, the way you go, the direction you take. So that the Torah, first of all, it's not primarily about us at all, it's about God. It's speaking in story form about the way God has acted in the history of the people of Israel, in the lives of the patriarchs and Moses and through to David and so on. It's actually stories picking up the essence of the way people saw God, the way God spoke and acted in their life. It's also, of course, about the way we respond to God. What should we do to be open to God's action, God's love, God's direction, God's will? How should we respond in a covenant way to this God who's chosen us? Well, that, of course, is appropriately called law. So we're covering both, but keep the focus primarily on God, and you will understand why this Torah was so precious to the people of Israel. Psalm 19, verse 7, the psalm is, of course, the psalm book is the hymnal of the Second Temple. So this is what they sang when they came together in the temple. And Psalm 19, verse 7 to 8, beautifully says, "The law of Yahweh is perfect. It revives the soul. The rule of Yahweh is to be trusted. It gives wisdom to the simple. The precepts of Yahweh are right. They gladden the heart. The command of Yahweh is clear. It gives light to the eyes. Notice I've been using the word Yahweh throughout. In many translations, it says the Lord, which is a direct translation of the Septuagint, the Greek. But the Hebrew text has just four consonants without the vowel sounds, and the difference between the Lord and Yahweh is that the Lord is a title, it's male, God is neither male nor female, whereas the word Yahweh is a name, it's already you're into connection, it's a communion word, it's calling someone by name. You can't limit God, of course, and in a way you can't name God, but it's an interaction, a communion between an I and a thou. So it's more personal, and it also transcends the male-female gender. So these people, Israel, and this is their summary of their Torah, they've been slaves in Egypt, where they had no law to protect them, they had no rights, but God heard their cry, liberated them from oppression, led them to freedom, and gave them a law, a way to live, which they believe would lead them to experience the fullness of life, in which the deepest desires of their hearts would be realized. Now, the Torah is full of many laws, cultic laws, food laws, behavior laws, legal systems. It's every culture, of course, needs plenty of these. And so the Torah is the same. So among many laws that regulated every aspect of their communal and personal lives, the Ten Commandments, actually called in Hebrew the Ten Words, hence our word in English, Decalogue, meaning the Ten Words, well, they have a special place. They're an attempt to summarize, they're an attempt to put in a brief way the essence of the way we have to respond to God, this God who acts in our, I'm using our in the sense of Israel, in our history. They express in summary form the basic imperatives which they were to follow in their relationship with God, which will be the subject of the first three commandments, which we're doing in this lecture, and in relation to our neighbour, which will be the subject of the rest of the commandments. They functioned, these ten words, as a kind of constitution of Israel. And the prophets used them as a basic reference in their critique of the nation. Jesus himself lived by them and referred to them. You might recall the rich young man who came to Jesus at once and said, "Look, I'm looking for something. What have I got to do to enjoy the life that you and your disciples clearly are enjoying?" He's missing something radically in his life. And he's a very rich man. And Jesus said, "Well, keep the commandments." And then Jesus quotes the commandments, which we're going to talk about. And the young man says, "Oh, look, I've followed them all ever since I was a boy. I've always followed them." And Jesus, we're told, looked at him and loved him and said to him, "Well, come, follow me. There's something more beautiful, more radical, more complete that I can offer you. Come." And sadly, the story, as you know, ends. And the young man went away because he was very rich. He couldn't let go what he treasured to listen to the deepest yearning of his heart and to kind of fly. He was in a gilded cage and he preferred that to flight, to freedom. So here's Jesus obviously respecting this tradition. Where the tradition came from is not—it's hard to tell, really, when it actually formulated as we've got it. I would suggest to you, as with most of the Torah, you best sit in, be with the people in exile in the 6th century when Jerusalem has collapsed and the temple has been destroyed, the king is no longer there, they've lost the Holy Land, and they're living with a whole lot of other refugees from different parts of the then Babylonian Empire, and they're making do as best they can in refugee camps and also in the towns, and they're being used for the war effort, and they're involved with the local communities in different ways. And it's there they had to rethink their whole, what are we essentially, mixing with these other people. They wanted to know, who are we? What's it mean to be us? Because now, for the first time, they're actually mixing with other peoples from the highlands of Canaan. Now they're part of a larger world, a bigger culture, a more multicultural situation. So it's perhaps there that they summarised and debated. You've got different schools looking at it. You've got the priests from one angle. You've got lay charismatic leaders on another angle. You've got the Isaiah school, who are very attached to the prophecies of Isaiah. You've got them. You've got a whole lot of people coming to the synagogue, debating, talking, discussing, wondering which is the best way to put things. And they come up with the Decalogue, this summary statement of the Torah, which goes right back to Moses some 600 years earlier. And no doubt there's been a lot of oral tradition and a lot of work and discussion gone on in those 600 years. But now we've got a formula which we're still treasuring. The first three commandments, which is our topic for tonight, focus on our relationship with God. The inspired authors knew that if we got our relationship with God wrong, everything would be wrong. All our relationships would be wrong. Whereas if we could delve into and get a right or an appropriate image of God and the way we relate to God, then that will create an ambience, a prayer heart, whereby we would be able to relate to our family, our neighbours, even perhaps our enemies, in a way that was in accordance with the covenant with this Yahweh God. What I've just said is really important, and I'm sure you're aware of it. If we do get God wrong, everything gets skewed. And if you look at our world today and ask yourself about our world and all the things that are done in the name of God in the so-called Christian world or the so-called world of Islam or the so-called Jewish world, look at Israel and the treatment of the Arab minorities there. Or when you look at our world and see all the things that people do in the name of God, it doesn't take long to realise that if we've got the God wrong, we're going to be using God for all kinds of power plays and self-advantage and cultural limits, and we won't relate properly to ourselves or to our world. So let's look now at the first commandment. First of all, a little bit of a warning. The numbering of the commandments varies in the Christian world. I'm following the numbering of the catechism, where the first commandment is actually quite long. Some Christian groups divide what I'm going to be calling the first commandment and into the first and second commandments, so the numbering from then on gets a bit skewed. So you have to always check what the reference is in when people say the fourth commandment. You mightn't be sure to which part of this text they're referring. The Catechism is following a very, very, very ancient tradition in the Greek and in the Western world, and it fits nicely with the Jewish traditional numbering. So that's what I'll be following. And it begins like this, where there are two texts of this, of the Ten Commandments. One is from the book of Exodus, and chapter 20, and one is from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 5. And they're almost identical, but even tonight we're going to see differences different schools of thought, different spiritualities highlight different aspects of these of this summary law, Torah. First begins, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Note, first of all, that that is not a monotheistic statement. The assumption behind that statement is that there are other gods. Well, there's the gods of Babylon, there's the gods of Persia, there's the gods of the Assyrians, there's the gods of Egypt, and that's the way they thought. But they're saying, no, our God is the one we are to have first and listen to and worship and adore, not the other gods. Which reminds us to say that monotheism is a very rare, very slowly developing within the religion of Israel, and even then never quite arriving. And probably, well, I'd say certainly, in the Christian world, likewise, while we would all tick the right box for am I a monotheist, am I a polytheist, you'd probably all tick the box that says monotheist, but are you? Am I? A monotheist is someone who believes there's one God, meaning every single human being, every creature, ultimately has the source of its being in the one principle, the one mystery, the one divine source, the one creator, God, Yahweh, called here, the Father of Jesus. That one God is the source of everything. So if I'm a monotheist, truly, I will not be saying there's only one God and he's my God and your God's wrong, because who is your God? Your God is my God. There's only one. So if I'm a true monotheist, you'll know, because I'll be utterly respectful of the young Muslim woman in the north of Afghanistan looking after her little children in the terrible situations they're involved in there, or the man weeping over his little baby in Kabul or in Iraq or wherever, East Timor, Sydney. I of course we'll debate, we'll all try and help each other clarify our idea of God, and not our ideas will be right, and that will involve a sharing and an intense desire to share everything beautiful we know and to listen to the beauty of other people's view too. Every time a little baby's born, our idea of God changes, grows, develops. Every time we know anything, we know something more about God. So it's a very humble, it's a very wonderful thing. So we want to share, and us as Christians, of course we'd want to share Jesus, just as the early Jewish Christians wanted to share the Father of Jesus with all their Jewish brothers and sisters, most of whom didn't accept it because they remained, and that was their decision, within their culture and their tradition, and they didn't dare this new journey that meant a lot to Paul and many other people, and to us now as Gentile Christians. So monotheism is rare, and it's a constantly refined idea. Hopefully by the time we all die we'll truly be monotheists and we'll have a wonderful respect for every created thing. Well, back to our commandment. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. This is the reference to history. This is Yahweh. This is the story of Moses and the big story of Israel. I took you out of the house of bondage. That's the one. So you shall have no other gods before me. And look at the lovely, Exodus chapter 20, Deuteronomy chapter 5. Listen to something that was said in Exodus chapter 19, just prior to this text, where on the mountain of Sinai, God says. Now, when you say God says in the Bible, you're not suggesting God actually speaks or that somebody heard something with their ear. You're talking, that's a story. You're talking about people's way of saying that what happened in our prehistory was from God, and it's divine, and its source is in God. And so you have God saying is getting to the very centre of their religious perception of the world. Well, God said, you are my special possession. I have brought you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. The God of the mountain of Sinai, Yahweh, brought them out of Egypt. They escaped the Egyptian forts and they've come through the desert, and here they've arrived safely on God's holy mountain. God, as it were, picked them up on his wings and carried them through the desert and landed them here in this sanctuary, this very holy place, God's mountain. I've borne you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Then he describes them. You are my special possession. The Hebrew is segula. My image of segula, I don't know, I've had it for years, and is of a little child coming into the church with a little rag doll screwed up and strangled by this little child. And because it's been in the with the dog and it's been under there and it's been dragged everywhere. But the little child won't be without it. And if you try and take the little child anywhere in the car or anywhere without this rag doll, it'll be crying and anxious because it's its little blanket, it's its little company, it's its segula. All God is saying to these people, you're my segula. You're my special possession. I can't live without you. I need you. I want you. I love you. You're mine. We're in this covenant relationship that's precious to me. You're my treasured possession. And he goes on, you are a priestly people, a kingly nation. You're a nation of that rule with this divine will. And you're a people who's holy and lives in this communion with God. That's the background before it. Now, come to the text, the identical text, in the book of Deuteronomy. In chapter 5, is the commandment. In chapter 6, we read, just after it, hear, Israel. The Hebrew for hear is Shema. This is the favourite prayer in Judaism, the Shema. It was written, it was kept in their phylacteries and on their doorposts and always before their eyes and on their arm and always to be remembered. And it reads, hear, Israel. That's the first commandment. Hear, listen. Listen, that's the first commandment for us to listen. Listen to your heart. Listen to God speaking within you. Listen to God speaking through the world. Listen to God speaking through the scientists and the artists and the dramatists and the painters and the lovers and the musicians and the neighbours, the people, the children, the teenagers. Listen, Israel. Yahweh is your God. Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, all your longing, and with all your might. Jesus quotes that text and he says this is the greatest commandment. It's the first. Listen, Israel, Yahweh is your God, Yahweh alone. You shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength. The God who's revealing his will to us here in this first commandment is the same God who heard the cry of the slaves in Egypt and raised up Moses to liberate them. He's the Lord. In the book of Exodus chapter 34, beautifully, he is the Lord, a God merciful, gracious, persistent in passionate concern, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. What a beautiful description of God. What we have to realize is we're dealing with the perceptions of a culture, say a 6th century culture, finally, with a long prehistory behind it. And it says some beautiful things about God, including that. But there are also oversights. They didn't know Jesus. In fact, the people who knew the Old Testament best are the ones who crucified Jesus. So the Jesus, the God that Jesus knew, is surprising to the people who wrote this text. And because they've got other texts, we'll see them, some of them later, they have this idea of God as a punishing God, as an angry God. They think, and the reason is quite simple, and we'll talk about it a bit more later. They have an assumption. It's all the way through the Old Testament scriptures, all the way through the Bible, prior to Jesus. And it might be an assumption that's in your mind as well, because it's still well and truly around. They had this assumption that God controls the world. Controls the world. Let's stop for a minute. We're all adults. Let me ask you a question. If someone tries to control you, do you experience that as love? No, you don't. Neither do I. What about if God loves the world? What about if God doesn't control the world? What about if God actually loves freedom and risks freedom and gives, and we try to respect other people's freedom, but we're not that good at it. We need to survive, and we have little control mechanisms, and we like to know where, you know, to organise things. I do anyhow, and I'm sure you all do, to keep a bit of predictability about things. God, no. God actually utterly respects my freedom, which means God takes the risk of sin, of terrible things happening, of injustice, of greed, of whatever you see when you look around the world and when you look into your own heart sometimes, sadly. But God respects this because the most beautiful thing about a human being is that we are able to be free and heroically beautiful in our freedom. A saint. And nothing else is worthwhile. So if God actually is the lover of the world, he doesn't step in and organise. He's not a puppeteer. He's not arranging who will die and who won't die, who will get better and who will get sick, who will be born deformed and who will be born beautifully, and who will be in a family that is very loving and who will be in a family that's not. All of this is random and choice and too much for me to talk about. Mostly we don't understand most of it. But God isn't pulling the levers. God has created this world and created us. And freedom allowed the world its own evolving mechanisms and our own human freedom. Once you get away from God controlling the world, see, they thought God controlled the world. So when Jerusalem lost, the people in exile looked back to Jerusalem, they thought, well, God must have organized the Babylonians to win the battle. We would say, wouldn't we, that no, they had better ammunition and there were more of them and they were more powerful. That's why they won. The people in exile thought, God must have allowed it, so we must have done something wrong. What did we do wrong? What do we need to learn from that? It's not a bad question, and they came up with some pretty good answers because they had done things that were wrong and they were neglectful. They were not following the justice of the Torah. But the question is really skewed. They could have been perfectly saintly and still lost the battle. We've seen plenty of that. So, okay, I'm sharing with you this beautiful text from Exodus chapter 34, speaking of God, Yahweh, a merciful and gracious God, persistent in passionate concern, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. And we treasure that statement. It's very beautiful. But let's remember that some of the images of God that these people came up with and that are in our Bible are actually inaccurate. They're based on assumptions that were unquestioned but were wrong. And it took Jesus to say, It was said to you of old, but I say to you. It took Jesus to say to the rich young man, yes, you've kept the commandments, that's wonderful. And he looked on him and he loved him and he said, come, follow me. There is something more beautiful in store for you. This first part of the first commandment, then, that commands that our focus be on Yahweh alone. Well, the Catechism goes on from number 2087 through to talk about various sins, in other words, various errors that we can make and various ways we can fail to keep that commandment. The sins against faith, hope and charity are all sins against this first commandment, because faith, hope and charity are theological virtues. They are the three aspects that we look at traditionally, right since St. Paul, and it's been through all our Christian tradition, three different ways of looking at the essence of our relationship with God. So sins against faith, let's look at some of them that they talk about in the Catechism. Refusing to accept what is revealed to us by God, refusing to accept it as true. As a statement, that's perfectly accurate. In fact, however, it's not easy to be sure what is revealed to us by God as true. And there'll be different opinions on that. Some will take... And this brings us to another matter of the Catechism, and perhaps one, I won't say it's weakness, because it can't do everything in one book. But you need to know, well, I need to know, that the Catechism gives us a kind of a whole picture of Catholic life. But Catholic teaching is much more like concentric circles. There's an inner circle, which is what we absolutely ground must believe. You think of the Trinity, Incarnation, the Eucharist, the sacramental, love of God. There's so many things in there that are, if I don't believe them, well, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a follower of Jesus. They're essentially, but then there's another circle just outside it, which has got important matters, which if you don't agree with, you really will misunderstand the central ones anyhow. And then it goes out and out and out and out, and right on the edge of the 39th circle or the 50th circle, you'll have lovely pious practices that work well in Southern Europe but not in Northern Europe. They fit perhaps female but not male psychology, or the other way around. They are culturally determined and limited, and you don't have to believe them or you don't have to practice them, and you can be a perfectly good Christian without doing it. So there's, you're going from the inner burning hot central truths right out to the vague kind of areas that are all part of the life but not essential to it. So when you say refusing to accept what is revealed to us by God is true, sometimes people think something's revealed by God is true but it's not, and they're not believing of it, could be very sensible. And this is the task of theology, to determine which are the absolutely essential truth and which are the less essential, more peripheral truths. Heresy is going against some specific issue which is of faith, fundamental. Apostasy is repudiating the whole of the Christian faith, knowingly, proudly, thinking we know better. Schism is breaking communion with the community. Now, that's actually quite a difficult one to look at too. From the Western Church, the traditional Western Church, the Church in communion with Rome, then the Eastern lung of the Church is said to be in schism. Well, that was the word used, schismatic, because they'd broken from communion with the See of Peter, with the Bishop of Rome. From their point of view, of course, they would see the Western lung of the Church as in schism, because they've broken away. They added things to the Nicene Creed which were not guaranteed in Nicaea. They lost a lot of the culture with the collapse of Rome and all of that, whereas the Roman Emperor was now in Constantinople in the East. So you'll have different opinions on this, different ways of looking. So we have to be a little bit careful. In fact, the Vatican Council on this matter of ecumenism very beautifully... Paul VI was the first, I think, to invent the word, but it's called redintegratio unitatis, the integration of unity, which is a wonderful concept. It means that when, for example, in the West, or the West and the East breaking in the 11th century finally, but for a long time prior to that too, and then at the time of the Reformation, the breakdown of nationalism and the different national churches that broke from the Roman Church, the Church in communion with Rome, all of this, when someone breaks from a family, something's lost. Something goes. We're all missing something. And the Church's desire today is to reintegrate so that every community shares its values with the others, and we find as we get closer to Jesus, get closer to each other, that we enrich each other with our life and our practices and our insights. And none of us have got a complete view of God. So schism, in other words, is actually it isn't good to break from the community. If it's done in pride, it won't help anybody. And the breakdown of Christian unity has been a terrible blight on the Christian world, and therefore on the world itself, how these Christians love one another. We have to come together somehow more beautifully and more truthfully. Now, sins against hope. On the one extreme, there's despair, losing all hope in God. At the opposite side is presumption. Oh, God's okay, I can do what I like, really. God's loving, God will still love me, whatever I do. So I don't have to respond to God, I don't have to pray, I don't have to look to God. Just live my life and this nice God will always, it'll come good in the end. No, it's not like that. Love is something you can never presume on in any situation, of course. It has to be nurtured, treasured. We have to respect it, we have to hold it gently, we have to... with love. It's too beautiful to be taken for granted or presumed. And the love of God, of course, is well beyond any presumption. It calls the best out of us. God's love doesn't want us to stay mediocre, distracted. Sins against charity, against love, some of them named in the Catechism are indifference, don't care how we live, ingratitude, lukewarmness, live with half our heart, half our mind. Sloth, too lazy to do the deepest things of life, or hatred of God. The Catechism then goes on to talk about the virtue of religion, which is related to the first commandment. This includes adoration, allowing ourselves to experience the awe and wonder of God. We can hardly help doing it when a baby's born. We kind of all do it then. Hopefully. We can't help doing it when we see nature at its most beautiful. Well, everything is beautiful in its own way. We have to, the virtue of the first commandment says to me, I love this image of Moses when he was taken in, when he saw the burning bush and God said, take off your shoes. He was in a sacred place. He had to treat it as sacred. So, when I enter into your life, it would be really good if I could literally or metaphorically take my shoes off. Because whenever we meet anybody, we're entering into something very sacred, mysterious, and at depth quite beautiful. Even if it's all mucked up and twisted, there's something of the divine at the heart of this other person, and we need to be attuned to it and respectful of it. And so that's adoration. Recognizing the mystery. Francis of Assisi is a beautiful example of it, and there are many others, but we need to do that. Prayer. Trying to live without prayer, without allowing rest in our heart and a space for silence and the mystery and opening ourselves to receive the love that is gentle and often silent and never forceful or loud or brash. Self-offering, we call the word sacrifice, is you self-sacrifice. It's actually a beautiful word, but mostly misunderstood because we don't know the meaning of sacrifice. Sacrifice in English comes from two Latin words, sacrum, which means sacred, you can hear it, sacred, and facere, to make. To sacrifice means to make holy, to put ourselves in a place where we will be made holy by God. To move away from the distractions and the whatever else of life there, and the silliness and the impetuous material and the self-focused thinking. Our desires are really our deepest needs, and they may well not be. And moving into a place where we're aware of the sacred, and where we offer our real selves to the mystery we call God, into communion, and allow God to make us holy. The virtue of religion, so-called religions, again a lovely word, to religo. Ligo means to bind, ligament, ligation, to bind. Religo, religion, means to bind back, to bind again, to hold something together that had been scattered all over the place, to get in touch with who we really are. That's the virtue of religion, and who what the world really is, and who God really is, and who you people really are at the depth. So that's the virtue of religion. Well, taking vows is another act of the virtue of religion. We think of the social duty of religion, gathering together, because religion isn't a private affair, it's just not between me and God in the privacy of my own conscience. It's personal, therefore it involves other people. It involves children and teenagers and family and old people and sick and all nations. And one of the beautiful things about the Catholic community is that it's very multicultural, and so it should be. And we need to come together. We'll come to that when we look at the third commandment. The need for religious freedom is essential in this first commandment. We can't be made to adore. We can't be made to pray. We can't be made to offer our real selves in prayer to the mystery that is God. It has to be free. So imposition of religion on anyone, children need to be trained. They need to know that certain values for the parents are absolutely basic to being at home. A tricky business and a difficult business in a culture like ours. But I'm sure we'd all agree that this isn't just free for all. Just as the food we eat isn't free for all, and the way we behave isn't free for all. We're interconnected. So children have to learn that their behaviour affects people and affects their parents immensely. So mutual sensitivity is needed, and talking and communication and caring and tears and real passionate longings. So these are all important. The commandment not to have other gods before Yahweh highlights a number of sins, and I'll conclude this part of the first commandment on this. There's a sin of superstition. Kind of believing every blooming thing. One of my good friends, the priest, used to say, the trouble with us all is that we believe too much. People believe too many things, so you just lose perspective. And superstition is not walking under this, not going there, looking at palm, looking at tea leaves, looking at whatever, going to people who will tell me about the future. There is no future. The future is only real when it's present. And the best way I can prepare for the present moment is not go along to someone who'll tell me what's going to happen in a week's time, because they can't know. The best preparation for the next moment for me is to live this one beautifully, truthfully, prayerfully, humbly, in relationship. That's the thing to do, to live the moment in communion with God and in communion with my fellow man and woman as beautifully as I may. That's the best thing to do. Learning to do that is the key. Not running here and running there to try and control the future or know it ahead of time, simply because it doesn't work. And it's failure to trust in the present moment and in God being the God we just heard about, full of love and inspiring us with his spirit. Idolatry, divination, magic, tempting God, sacrilege, simony, selling religious things for money, atheism, wiping the whole thing. Mind you, I actually think the second best thing to be in the modern world would be an atheist. Because at least that gets rid of all the junk that's around in that word God. But there's something much better than being an atheist. An atheist is someone who says, there's nothing outside what I can see. There's nothing off my radar screen. So everything is tested by my own overrated intelligence and my own systems of getting evidence and knowing what's in there. No, the world is bigger than that. Believing in God isn't locking oneself in anywhere. It's keeping the windows and doors of the mind and heart open to the sacred and the mystery. And the people who do that beautifully end up very beautiful people. The scores are on the board, as it were. We see what it is. So it's not locking in, it's leaving open, and it's not limiting myself to the limits that my scientifically trained mind or my overrated logic demand. Agnosticism is just taking the easy way out and saying the whole thing's too hard, so I'll live without it. Let's leave the God thing aside, too complicated, and I'll just live from day to day, do the best I can, be nice to people, and the rest, live by the golden rule, perhaps, and do all these things. No, that's a good thing to do, but it's not good enough, because there is a presence and a mystery and a source and a love, a rich religious mystery that envelops us all. And so we would do well to follow the example of the mystics, follow the example of Jesus, to follow the example of the saintly people who've lived their lives well, but drawn on something bigger and more wonderful than their own limits. So we now continue with and conclude the second part of the first commandment. The first part we just saw is a very brief sentence. I am Yahweh your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, so that limit that directs the history of it, out of the house of bondage. It's a liberating God. You shall have no other gods before me. Then, according to the traditional numbering, the first commandment continues. You shall not make for yourself a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or be enslaved by them. Quite beautiful. In their world, of course, they looked around and all the temples had gods imaged with different kinds of icons of the gods. But for the Jews, no. They realized God was beyond all this. So to avoid the temptation to limit God, they avoided making images of their God. Some people use this to say we shouldn't have, for example, crucifixes. We shouldn't have little memory cards of Jesus on the cross or Mary at the foot of the cross, or we shouldn't have pictures of saints on our desk that we might admire or may have known and admire because you were making an image of God. Hold it. These aren't images of God. These are God himself they're forgetting. First of all, they're forgetting we don't worship these things. We don't worship these icons that we might have around us. They are a reminder. They focus our attention. They are a little garden of rest against all the other images that are bombarding us from every direction. So they give a bit of focus to our imagination, our mind, our heart, our memory. We're not worshipping them. And secondly, it's God himself who gave us an image. Paul calls Jesus the icon of God. He is the one who shows in his face, his smile, his words, his manner of living, his decisions, ultimately his way of dying. He's the one who reveals who God, what God is really like, in as a human form can show. Other things show it too, of course, the nature in its most beautiful, the sunset, the moon in the sky, etc. Music, and the flight of birds, people. Jesus is a focal word, a word that purely, beautifully shows us this is what God is really like. So if we want to know what God is like, we've got to look at Jesus. And some of our ideas of God, some of the ideas of God you'll find in the Bible, you'll find them in tonight's commandments, have to be relativized. We have to say it was said, but when we look at Jesus, we realize, no, some of those ideas of God that these wonderful groups of inspired people back in the 6th century and earlier and later, they were imperfect because they'd never really seen God as beautifully as God wishes to be revealed. And God wished to be revealed in Jesus in the perfect way. So to have the virtue of religion not only inspires words, like the words that are in the text of the Bible we're studying, but God inspires sculpture, painting, music, drama, poetry, and words. And the images that we have, the photos that we might have of our mother or father or the saints that we may have known or the saints we've heard about, these are... Why would we stop praying to the saints just because they die? Why would I ask my mother to pray for me and then stop asking her when she died? Don't we believe in the resurrection? Don't we believe that people are in communion with God? Do they stop loving us because they've died? I mean, for heaven's sake, surely it's more. And their presence is more in God than it could be here on earth, where physical distance can separate us and so on. So praying all prayers to God, but praying to the saints, having these images, if they help you, don't need them, don't worry about them. But if they help you, why not? And they're not breaking this first commandment, because we're not making a graven image of God in having these. The communion of saints goes well beyond that. And then the commandment continues, in fact concludes, "For I, Yahweh, your God, am a jealous God." Just pause for a minute. Jealous. The Hebrew, the Greek word for jealous, the word of the New Testament, the word is zelos. And it's translated in two ways. Zealous and jealous. Both. So that gives us a hint. Often jealousy and envy are confused. Let's try and clarify them. They often have the same feeling when they're a vice. Jealousy, you are jealous of what you have and don't want others to have. You are envious of what others have and you want for yourself. That's the distinction between jealousy and envy. So jealousy is about what you have. When we talk about God being jealous, we're not obviously saying that God has a vice. We're saying that we, God's people, mean so much to God that he's passionately concerned that we live and live to the full, and he won't just sit back and do nothing about it when we start to fritter away our lives or behave badly or sin or hurt others and hurt ourselves. God is desperately, as it were, passionately, lovingly concerned for us. That's God's jealousy, not wanting us to stray from him and therefore from communion with him and therefore from life. Not to break our connection with the source of who we are. That's the God. I am Yahweh your God, a jealous God. Now here's the bit where they're wrong. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Hate meaning do not follow my covenant, do not obey my will, do not follow the path that I've offered them, the path to life. Doesn't necessarily mean hate in feelings. It means not love, not listen, not obey, not follow. Well, it says visiting the iniquity of the fathers. That could give you the idea, which they had, that God would punish me for what my father did, and he'd punish my children for what my father did. And even to the fourth generation, God would punish people for what their great-grandfather or mother had done. Because God's controlling the world, that's what they thought. We talked about it earlier. And if you think of God as controlling the world, then anything bad that happens to me because of what my parents did is seen as the punishment of God. Of course, it's not. It's the effect of what my parents did. And probably this is a pretty reasonable text if you turn it slightly. If I behave badly, then it's going to affect my children. And it's going to affect my grandchildren. Excuse me, it may even affect my great-grandchildren. But at least it peters out. Evil doesn't go on and on and on and on and on. It wears itself out as the river goes downstream. And the beautiful part of this statement is in the next verse. I'll read it all to you again. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Thousands of generations. If you do something, or I do something bad, yes, you sometimes can't pull it back and wish you hadn't done it, but you've done it, and it does hurt your children, and it does hurt your grandchildren, and it does hurt a bit longer, probably. If you do something beautiful, it's going to affect your children, your grandchildren, their children, for a thousand generations. It goes on and on and on. Dark and light are not in struggle. We're not dualists. Love transcends a million darknesses. A little child can light a penny candle and shatter the darkness in a big room. Light and dark are not comparable. The sun rising, the whole of the night sky is banished. So if we do something hurtful, and we might, and we do, then the best thing we can do is do something loving, because the loving thing is a thousand times more powerful, healing, productive than anything we might do that's wrong. So regret the past, learn from it, apologise for it, do all that, of course, as best you can. And sometimes it still doesn't solve problems because other people mightn't want them solved or whatever, or we mightn't quite see the extent of what we've done enough to satisfy them, in any case, though we're trying our best. So we have to do all that. But the focus can't be on just regret and imploding into whipping ourselves for what we did. The task now is to love, to let God love through us to the full, because God shows steadfast love to thousands of those who love him and keep his commandments.